ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm Carrington Clark.
And I'm Alan Kohler.
In 2026, business big and small is moving at a rapid pace. And ABC Business Daily is here to help you cut through the noise and spin. Monday to Thursday.
And on Friday, I sit down with business leaders, founders, creators, change makers, and those in the know to ask them how they see the world, because that's business.
All in the ABC Business Daily feed on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Labor may have won the South Australian election by an absolute landslide, but the orange wave that swept through the state stole some of that focus. One Nation claimed close to 22% of the vote. It's the best election result in nearly 30 years for that party, cannibalising the Liberal Party's vote and cementing One Nation's dominance beyond the polls. But it's not just the Liberals taking lessons from the result. Labor is also wary of the populist party's rise, with newly re-elected Premier Peter Malinauskas warning his party against hubris. A smart message, a message that's no doubt reverberating in the corridors of Canberra where we are. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis.
And I'm Jacob Grieber. So you got your South Australian on, I see.
I have. All the way with Peter Malinauskas, can I say, who is the first point to make a huge political rock star for the Labor Party and the Labor movement. I mean, this result for him is breathtaking and should be seen as just that on its own before we get to the fracturing of the right-wing vote and what that means. Like, it is extraordinary, the result he had.
Absolutely. It's a repeat, really, of what happened federally, isn't it? For Anthony Albanese last May, 94-seat majority. I don't think we're quite able to say what the majority is going to be in South Australia, but it's something comparable. It's thumping endorsement. They've won solidly, is all you can say. Interestingly, and we can get into this, off again, historically not the highest primary vote in the 30s, in fact. And this is, it's cementing the new reality that you form government out of a low primary vote, and it's all about the preferences. And then in this case, as we've seen, it is once again the fracturing of the vote on the right, the conservative vote. Doing incredible damage to the coalition's brand, any sense that it can form government in this country anywhere other than perhaps Queensland. It's a really big blow for them, and they're reeling off it today, as many would have expected, I guess.
So what's really fascinating about it, and I wanted to start with, you know, really acknowledging the big win for Labor, because that's really a huge part of the story, and then getting into what is an important story, but really the vote for the right generally I don't think was very impressive. And so you can't say that they're storming home. There's not. It's more about how that the right-wing vote is changing and what people are looking for there and the influence it's having on broader politics. So when we first got that news poll earlier this year, which showed federally One Nation ahead of the Liberal Party, that was a political, as Casey Briggs said, political earthquake in this result. It was a political earthquake in polling. The fact that it's now translated.
Well, it shows the polling's right.
So for pollsters, I mean, they must
a big win. Big win for pollsters.
So it shows, actually, because it's very hard to poll some of these things, that it is translating. Few caveats. I think everyone knew in South Australia, including the voters, that Malinauskas was going to win and win big. So it's easier to do a protest vote and send a message in that context. However, One Nation getting more number ones, so to speak, than the Liberals is existential for the Liberal Party and real. And if One Nation can repeat it in Farrah, in that by-election, that's like a new world we're in. And
As Barnaby's been saying, tongue very firmly in cheek, it's time for the Liberal Party to stop splitting the One Nation vote.
That's so ridiculous.
So we're in that world now where indeed the One Nation is the second party behind Labor. And his point is that it's Liberals who are voting to the Liberal Party instead of coming straight to One Nation that are the problem. It's a bit of a joke, but obviously it's turning what has always been the historical charge against One Nation, that it's splitting the Liberal Party's vote or the Coalition's vote. And lo and behold, it's actually the other way around. Look, diabolical, the people who have to try and make this work are Matt Canavan and Angus Taylor. They have a huge challenge on their hand now resisting this One Nation push. And yeah. You mentioned Farah. I think we talk about Farah a lot, but it will be the first
national test.
It'll be the first national test. And I think this is going headlong into the energy issue, the energy crisis that the war in Iran is kicking up. That electorate will test very much some of these themes that we're talking about across the country. But I don't know what you thought. Did the One Nation vote, it doesn't translate into necessarily a lot of seats in the South Australian Parliament. One so far, and I think an upper house seat, have I got that right?
Mm-hmm.
So will there be disappointment in that for One Nation, given, yes, you got a big primary vote, but it doesn't translate into bums on seats?
Yeah, okay, a couple of things on that. You watch this space. The hard right, which is what I'm describing One Nation as, have already, I think, you know, if you listen to some of their rhetoric, are really kind of building a campaign around this idea that our electoral system is kind of stacked against groups like them. Now, we have a great electoral system in my view. I think compulsory preferential voting has served our country well. However, it's clearly not suiting them specifically well right now, and they will kind of build grievance and question marks around our political system, which I think is going to be interesting. Watch that space, because I think people also who are diehard voters of them and those swinging might also be frustrated.
So the alternative would be what? What we have in Tasmania, the ACT, some sort of proportional representation. I mean, it might even be in the interests of the Liberal Party at this point in time.
Yeah,
if you're coming third in a lot of seats,
for people to sit there campaigning against about a change to our electoral system because the electoral system doesn't work for you all of a sudden, like, come on,
it's not a good look, is it?
Nah.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think, but also you're right though about like beyond how One Nation might be feeling or its leadership, then there's of course the people who vote for them, and they might feel like, oh, well, this isn't getting me where I want, so that's real. Like if they're sort of voting for obscurity, right? Like you're voting for a protest that's not being listened to. But I want to challenge the idea that it's not being listened to. Because if you listen to, a lot of listen to's here, the words of the new Premier, well, he was the Premier, he's Premier again, Peter Malinauskas, I reckon there's a bit of listening to, actually, if you listen to the words of the Prime Minister for a while on patriotism and progressive patriotism. These guys are not just noting the economic grievance of the people voting for One Nation. They are leaning into the cultural issues, the flag, Australia Day, all of the things that symbolise sort of right-wing populism, and trying to own them a little bit for the centre and for Labor. And I think that's really interesting.
It's very interesting. And it's not as straightforward, I suspect, you're saying as well. Don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think, you know, you've looked at the Prime Minister tried to create a distinction over the weekend. He went to a series of ethnic communities, including one where he didn't get a warm welcome from some quarters. He also was emphasising that Labor supports large Australian communities that come from other parts of the world. And I think that's really, really critical in all of this. One of the things we saw in South Australia, it seems, and One Nation still does stand a chance. I think there's at least three other seats where they could still win lower house seats. My observation is that is in areas where you'd call them outer suburbs. They're turning against governments and but all the mainstream parties, and they're starting to flirt now with One Nation. But of course, in the outer suburbs, you also have very, very large ethnic communities. So fascinating mix. I think it'll be different in different parts of the country. Barnaby Joyce, just to go back to him, I think he's in a little bit of hot water for suggesting immigration was a bit like choosing cattle as a sort of remark that went out. Now, I don't know that that's quite what he meant, but yeah, he's going to get a bit of heat for that.
Yes, he will.
And probably rightly so. Language gets loose and then it has an ugly consequence to it. Anyway, the point I think is that the Prime Minister is trying to work out how to react. The Premier in South Australia is trying to work out how to react. They're all trying to get a lesson from it. And the patriotism thing's interesting, that would be one of the takeouts.
Well, I think they know the chief thing, and I think Malinowskis said this. What did he say? The first chief thing he said to David Spears on Insiders is housing. Like, so I think it's wise to always focus on the economics, because people are really struggling at the moment. I mean, that's not news to anyone listening. So the economics is fundamentally, inherently, dominantly the reason people are behaving the way they are. And it's totally logical and reasonable that they are too. Interest rates up, war in the Middle East, fuel prices sky high, housing out of reach. I mean, that is a perfect storm of economic grievance right now. Mm. So,
and I do wonder, I mean, I didn't follow the twists and turns, but do you think the war, maybe in the last 2 weeks of that campaign in South Australia, might have had an effect on voters to stick with what they knew?
Well, there is always, at least the political orthodoxy is that, of course, people are largely vote, you know, in their interests and are more conservative at times of upheaval. I think state elections, I really do believe that people can tell the difference between the federal and the state
and stuff. The issues they control.
Yeah, and Malinowskis on his own is just an absolute rock star of a politician. He has the gift of the gab. He really knows how to nuance a message. I think he is genuinely a very gifted politician, and Labor is very lucky to have him as their leader, right? Because he's...
And by all accounts, he didn't take it for granted, because I think it was quite the opposite. I think he got quite nervous about the fact that he was seen as a lay-down mazare. At one point people were predicting zero seats for the Liberal Party. I think there was some speculation about that. And so if you're the leader, then expected to win like that.
He's the anti-hubris, isn't he?
Yeah, that's a very dangerous place to be as a leader.
You do not want to be there. No, you're right. He was very aware of that. And also, even in going on as he did about the sort of cultural issues right after this, that demonstrates that he can see... You know, this is the thing. If you're smart at politics, and not everyone is in this building, but the people who are...
You'd be surprised.
Geniuses. They look ahead on the horizon. And if they see trouble coming, my friend, they try to get ahead of that. And that's what I'm seeing from him. And I think the Prime Minister can be also attributed with doing that a little bit. Whether it's enough... And whether draping themselves in a Labor version of the flag, I mean, it's the same flag, but you know what I mean, in terms of the message, just kind of puts a stop to any potential upheaval on that. I'm not sure, but I know what they're trying to do. And what they're trying to do is send a message, which is we're not anti your national symbols. We're not anti the flag. We're not, so that those who maybe are grumpy, and then are convinced by some of these arguments, think, well, Labor's not against these things, rather than becoming a left-wing trope that they're anti-Project Australia.
I think, yes, and I think the other one too, just you said, you know, Malinowskis was quick to bring up housing in his interview yesterday in the aftermath of that election. And one of the reasons I suspect he's done that, and I've heard this from Labor sources at the federal level, a recognition that One Nation has been very successful in connecting housing and immigration. Those two issues go together. You can't afford a house because of immigration. You can't have your grandkids living in your neighbourhood because they can no longer afford it, because immigration pressures have made it impossible. So those two things are connected. And for Labor to continue to win, they need to reassure voters that they care about the housing issue and are genuinely moving the needle on it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they will be vulnerable to losing to One Nation. And there was a slight touch of that, of some people leaving Labor to vote One Nation, but I suspect their preferences brought them back to Labor in the end. But it's going to be something Labor has to watch federally. Now, you might say, yes, they could do, they might have been tested in Farrah, but of course, Labor's not running in Farrah.
No, Labor's not running in Farrah, and you just, ever since he spent all that time there, he's just, Farrah.
It's a lovely part of the world. I won't hear anything else.
You will not.
Did you see, by the way?
Refuse to talk about anything else.
Yeah. Did you see over the weekend that in the local paper, and I'm going to look it up because I think you should always give credit where credit is due. It's the Border Mail, I believe, had a photo of Bob Katter with Michelle Millthorpe, who is the, her colour is orange, which is the same colour as One Nation, but she would claim to have her
orange.
Her own sort of tinge of it. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Bob Katter, the veteran independent from way up north, someone you might say is a bit of a proto One Nation sort of character, backing the independent in Farah Michelle Millthorpe. So very interesting there, to the degree that he sways votes down there. But she won't be unhappy about that endorsement.
No, because it sort of is an endorsement from the right. You know, just that I'm not just sort of a cookie cutter, maybe soft left, like I can be something
right,
bigger.
What the National Party and the Liberal Party are trying to do is portray her as a Teal or as a Climate 200 candidate.
Yes.
They will be doing everything they can to make that connection. But here you have Bob Catter coming in and saying, as far as he's concerned, that's okay.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. All right, I want to pivot to something that is extremely on front of mind for people, and that's fuel. The barbecue stopper conversation, if you can afford your barbecue. The International Energy Agency has now declared this crisis is our worst in history. Oh, well, that's relaxing. Good to know for anyone who didn't notice by, you know, having to fill their car up with petrol or buy diesel or just run any business at the moment. Now, last week, National Cabinet met. They announced that National Fuel Supply Task Force Coordinator. And it now seems Labor is considering a tax on gas and coal exports. You wrote about this, Jacob, over the weekend. That's really, really interesting and exactly what many on the right and the left, so we're talking from the Greens base to the One Nation base, people want this.
People are very exercised by the idea that as a net exporter of energy, that we would somehow now be paying a whole lot more for energy in this country. Of course, energy is insanely complicated. Different people different companies have invested at different times, so they'll want their return. But yeah, this there's a sort of nationalistic overtone to all of it that's very difficult for the major parties to ignore. Labor, we can start with Labor. Mm-hmm. Labor tried to shake it up at the end of 2022, when they first came in. You'll recall domestic gas prices went through the roof. A lot of manufacturers were very upset. The government tried to do a deal with the industry to keep more gas here. That then was overturned by really a campaign from the manufacturing groups, the unions, Ed Husic and others kicked up a lot of noise about it. They then intervened directly in the market. That resulted in a one-year pretty much freeze in investment in new gas exploration and development. Mm. So they're very sensitive about that, sending the wrong signal to the industry. Likewise, the coalition, which you'll recall, took a policy to the election of having a gas reservation, which is a form of a tax, really, when you think about it. They're forcing private enterprise to change its behaviour to favour one customer over another for a lower price. They haven't renewed that policy. So that's a question for them. And then, as you say, you've got One Nation supportive of it, and you've got all the crossbench. In fact, a short time ago, they all were standing up here in Parliament, about six or seven of them, all going through why they want to see action in this space. It's interesting, the gas price hasn't yet spiked.
No.
I'm a little bit surprised. I thought it might have by now, but it does not appear to have. You can still, at the Woolloombilla hub, which is in Queensland. It's a big gas hub. It's around about, I think it's around about $10, which is not really high by any means if you're talking about a global oil shock or energy shock. So interesting to see how that develops. But the politics is already racing ahead to a world where LNG prices shoot up, because 20% of LNG comes out of the Middle East and is currently on hold.
Yeah. Look, I think the energy debate at the moment is kind of the biggest show in town for Labor. How to get that right from the Strait of Hormuz and the consequences of that, and how to approach that to, of course, you know, the upcoming budget and taxation and all of that. Like, this is a very big project. Like, there is nothing bigger at the moment in, I think, the government's kind of existence than getting this stuff right. They're not overreaching. Remember, these are people who are stung by the resources mineral tax years ago, for anyone old enough to remember, where there was a massive campaign against it. The big question I have is, will they potentially have more courage, if you want to call it that, even if there is a royal campaign against it, on the basis that the world has changed, politics has changed, populism being on the rise actually advantages ideas like this. Do they have a newfound sense of purpose around these things?
They'll have to thread that needle of making sure that exports still go to the destinations where people have paid for long-term contracts. Countries like China, Japan, South Korea. If they threaten that, then that's a whole other ball game. And it's already interesting. We're already starting to see the start of people calling for the government to lobby some of the Southeast Asian countries that supply us with liquid fuels.
Mm-hmm.
So the avgas, the petrol, the diesel, they come from places like Thailand. Now, those countries are in real strife with energy prices globally spiking, and there's talk of them quarantining any of those sort of liquid fuels to come south to Australia. And that means there's probably a real diplomatic effort that has to go in here. But Australia has leverage. Australia exports gas in the other direction. So it's a bit of a two-way street. It'd be interesting to see how that develops and how desperate things get. And I think to your point about the budget, we're in this world now of how desperate do we all become? How bad does it get? They're unknowable things. We don't have answers for them. But my sense is they're really starting to prepare contingencies for really unorthodox things that you might do really only in a time of war or COVID or that type of a dislocation. It's heading back into that space.
Yeah.
So we can talk about it.
I think we're definitely going to the dislocation space, as you say. And I think it's a rather bleak conversation. Those of us who are still stung by the COVID era, which is like I think all of us, would be nervous about that, right? Very nervous about that. But at the same time, the contingencies have to happen. So what are some of them? Well, one of them is working from home. Now, I don't know. Many people do it by choice. If you're probably listening right now, you might be one of those people. But of course, this huge uptick happened as a result of COVID when we were in lockdowns and we were forced to work from home, those of us who could. Are we really going into that territory again? And is Labor really opening the door to it? Because, of course, for those who aren't like making the link, well, that's if you haven't got enough fuel, you don't want to get your workers on the road using finite fuel to get to jobs. Like, these are the necessary things you might need to do if there's a shortage.
And like, let's face it, this is what you want a good government for. This is why you want government with some fiscal firepower, an ability to deploy resources or take on insurance. You need governments to be in good enough shape to do that. There's a million things they could do. They could make states could make public transport free. That would be a cost that they could bear potentially. Long term, it'll have to be paid back. But it means if you are concerned about the amount of fuel that's available in the economy, well, get more people to use public transport in an affordable way. That takes pressure off that. Staying working from home if you can. It's interesting, government's saying we're not telling people what they should do. We're just saying
they're never telling people what they should do again.
If you can, you might consider it.
Yeah.
Next comes maybe you don't need to fly to across the country to do X, Y, Z, or that trip to the coast that you were planning. All those things start to build up. Like it's iterative, it's happening slowly is my sense, but when we get into April, especially the middle of April, Chris Bowen, the energy minister, has been dropping some big hints about it's all fine now, but mid third week of April time, it's no longer so fine. So they'll also be hoping that Donald Trump can finish this war as soon as possible, because otherwise we are in that world where we're talking about these kinds of measures. But governments, you want governments to have that fiscal firepower to manage that type of issue. The last truck that you want unable to do its job, probably the second last truck, is the one that delivers your milk and bread. The last truck would be the fire brigade and the ambulances. You know, it's so you get into that prioritizing need, Maslow's hierarchy of need in a crisis. But it is that sense that we're now heading into that space. And yeah, it is a bit sort of depressing, but I think they're thinking about it, which is a good sign. You want them thinking about it.
Well, they have to think about it. There is no alternative. But you're right. All of the reluctance to kind of go too hard, too fast, or talk about it in extreme terms is sort of the hangover of COVID. Like, you know, the draconian nature of all of that has made governments very gun-shy about using a form of language at the very least, which sounds top-heavy, sounds like command and control. All of that is a very big political consideration, because I think a lot of the disruption we've seen even in our politics is still a consequence of people being a little bit stung by that time. Yeah. I really do think so.
Yeah.
Now, Parliament is back. That's why I'm here. You're here to do the same thing. We watch the Parliament. We report on the Parliament. We tell you what's happening. What can you expect this week, Jacob? Like, why are we even here?
Well, yeah, why are we? It's a good question. Like, in terms of legislative agenda,
are we doing much?
There's not a lot there. There's not a lot there. It's sort of being held.
A few bits and bobs.
I think it's interesting to see how the coalition reacts. There was a story this morning that they're going to go harder on immigration. They're going to have a policy on immigration that's much more draconian. That'll probably be interpreted as a straight up reaction to what's happened in South Australia, and they're concerned about this upcoming by-election. So they'll harden their language around that. I have no idea. Why are we here? Like, what's the big bill that's going to change the country that's coming?
Why are we here? Well, I mean, there's a few. I asked you. Look, I think we are in a rolling crisis anyway, and so because of the Middle East war and the consequences. So I actually think the government will be absolutely consumed, and this issue will dominate all week. Well, that's the truth, as it should in many ways. Like, governments, of course, need to be big and thoughtful and think about reform and all the things that you and I are like are our pet favourite things. But equally, they are often managing events that come their way. I mean, that's life, right? Like, that's actually, you know, from the personal to the political, that's how we manage life. We are often responding to things. And right now, they're in massive rolling National Security Committee meetings, ERC, which is the, you know, economic cabinet group that gets together and constructs the budget. Like, they are knee-deep in all of this.
They're almost, I mean, it's daily pretty much, those meetings. This is the time when the budget gets really nailed down, and they're nailing it down in this incredible uncertainty.
That's what I was about to say. Yeah. So try and, you know, not that I ever want us to be too, you know, crying our heart out for people who are kind of, you know, doing all right in life, who are, you know, senior politicians that have a nicer life than a lot of people doing the hard yards. But these guys are now trying to make a budget where literally you don't know tomorrow whether Trump's going to, I don't know, blow up an oil field or something. Like, I'm, you know, making up a scenario.
Well, he's threatened to do something.
Well, correct, right? So obviously as soon as that happens, that scales up the war, the economic ramifications are enormous, blah, 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 insert crisis. And you've got to write a budget today for that to be delivered in May. Oh, come on.
Like, yep, they're going to earn their, they're earning their keep.
It's beyond earning their keep. They have to be Nostradamus, right? Like, they have to model so many scenarios. They have to have a budget in the back pocket, so to speak, which I kind of asked the Treasurer, do you have like a plan B budget? Like, how does the budget work when these things are happening?
Well, I think the reality is there is damage that's real. It's being done, and it'll take a while to get over that damage, even if it all finishes very, very soon. I think they can be certain of that in the budget. That there's a shock that now has to be dealt with. The other thought too is just, I mean, at what point do Americans say they've had enough? I mean, America's ability to withstand high energy prices is extraordinary to me. The MAGA crowd that brought Donald Trump in are often some of the people who are going to feel this energy hit the most in America, the people who wanted Donald Trump because he was, quote unquote, going to tear down the elites of the Democratic Party or even what was then the previous Republican Party. Those elites, they'll be all right. They're not going to suffer. They've got means to get through this crisis, but it's the ordinary folks who don't. Very interesting.
Yeah.
That's, to me, when does that crack? When does that open up in America?
That is a very good question, one that we don't have an answer to, but we're watching it closely. Well, that's it for Politics Now today. I'm going to be joined by Raf Epstein for tomorrow's podcast. If you have a question, send it to the partyroom at abc.net.au. Fran and I will answer your question in a special episode. Jacob, thank you.
Always good. Well, you've got a big day tomorrow too with Ursula von der Leyen is in Canberra tomorrow, trade. Maybe speaking to the Parliament.
Love a bit of trade. It is going to be a big week. And
she will apparently be the first female leader to address Parliament, foreign leader to address Parliament. Now, she's the head of the EU, not the head of a country per se. But
head of a lot of countries. Yeah. Let's go with that.
A bloc.
A bloc, that's right. That's extraordinary. The first female. Wow, 2026. We take a while to work these things out, don't we, Jacob?
Get there in the end.
Yeah, about time, hey? Thanks, Jacob. See you soon.
All the best. See ya.